Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm and ZipRecruiter. Well, we're all getting ready for the Labor Day weekend, and there are new poll numbers out. I think the ugliest poll number for Donald Trump, and there's a whole bunch of ugly out there, is the fact that he's now underwater on the economy, despite the fact that, you know, things have been going pretty well. I mean, the bad news is that 6 in 10 voters, registered voters, think the economy is excellent or good. 18% say excellent, 43% say good. And for the first time since 2016, June 2016, more Americans say the economy is getting worse than say it's getting better. And this is the first time slightly more Americans say that Trump's policies are hurting the economy, 41%, than say they are helping the economy, 37%. So here's the one issue that Donald Trump has been floating on, although he's gotten negative ratings on virtually everything else. And so obviously we're going to be talking about the economy. And joining me on the podcast today is Scott Lincecum. Scott, I was about to, you know, introduce you as a trade lawyer, but that's your day job. You're an adjunct at the Cato Institute. And for readers of The Bulwark or anybody that spends any time on Twitter, Scott is an avid advocate for free trade, which makes you kind of a lonely guy these days. I mean, you know, being right about this, that it is a lonely guy because, of course, the Republican Party has gone off with Donald Trump. Democrats have never been totally down with it. So, first of all, you know, thanks for joining me today. So,
well, thanks for having me.
So, how's the trade war going? Okay, before we get into that, I'm glad that you're a trade lawyer, not an economist, because I really want someone who can speak English about this, because it occurs to me that this is one of those moments, and it has tremendous consequences, when our ignorance about the economics is coming back to bite us in the butt. And the president of the United States is as ignorant or more ignorant than anyone else on all of this. So I guess the more cosmic question is, why do people not understand that trade wars never are easy and they never work out?
Right. Well, it's one of those, doomed to repeat it issues. And in fact, I wrote a paper a couple of years ago for Cato entitled Doomed to Repeat It, all about the long history of the failures of American protectionism. And yeah, you know, for a couple hundred years now, we have had as close to a consensus as you can get among economists who can't really agree on anything, from the left, the right, and the center, that free trade is good and that protectionism is really bad. Not only bad because it hurts consumers and companies that you know need imports and that kind of stuff, but also because it really rarely achieves its policy objectives. The fact is that, you know, protected companies still end up going out of business. The jobs that are protected, you know, that are super expensive to protect, but also those jobs end up disappearing anyway in the long run. And even in terms of using protectionism and tariffs to achieve, you know, open foreign markets or use in trade negotiations, the United States has not been relatively successful in doing that. And so, you know, we have this long history of this. So why don't people know that? Well, I think it's pretty much a classic case of disinterest, you know, rational ignorance. The fact is that most Americans work in services. Most Americans do not have jobs and lives that depend on the day-to-day trade world. The fact is that most of us, even though, of course, our daily lives are greatly affected by trade, the fact is that, look, most of us aren't in importing or exporting. Most of us don't work in manufacturing. And if we do work in services, again, they're going to be kind of domestically oriented. So because of that, you know, this is, you know, classic case of concentrated costs and diffuse benefits for free trade. And thus, the only people really paying attention are those who are seeking protection, whereas the rest of us just kind of shrug and don't know. And so I think that's a big part of it. The other part of it is that certain parts of trade are really counterintuitive. You know, the theory of comparative advantage, for example, is kind of hard to understand. And, you know, this is the idea that even if a country is better at making everything than another country, it still benefits for that country to specialize in what it does best, and then to trade with the other country that it can do, that country can produce what it does even second best. And that actually makes everyone better off. Okay, now, and that, again, it's kind of a tough thing to understand, but right. It's quite important.
Yeah, it is a little bit more esoteric because the politics have always been easier to be in favor of.
Yeah.
Always been easier to be in favor of protectionism, right? To say to an industry, you're being ripped off. I'm going to have a policy that's going to do something for you. And
right.
I remember, you know, long before Donald Trump, I went to speak to some an organization. I think they were metal workers. And the one thing they wanted to talk about was how terrible free trade was, how terrible China was, and how we needed to engage in a trade war with China. And I will tell you that you can give the economic meta story, but they weren't buying it. And so that was probably an early indicator how the easier case to make, even though it's wrong, is protectionism.
Yeah,
it's appealing. It's visceral. It's like, I can do something for you. And the person who argues for, yes, but in general, the marketplace will work. And, you know, let's face it, people in Michigan are going, screw the general, you know, the general economy, right, or the world economy, or what's more efficient. I want a policy that's going to protect my job right here. I'm a steel worker,
right,
and I want to slap tariffs on foreign steel.
Yeah, and well, and this is kind of classic, going back to our Bastiat, right? Seen versus unseen. You know, the fact is that the benefits of protectionism are seen. The costs are mostly unseen. You know,
right.
And then the flip side of that is the same, that the costs of free trade, meaning a lost job, are seen. They're very acute, and they're right in front of you. It's far more difficult to see the benefits of free trade. And look, you know, contrary to the conventional wisdom out there, it's not just about cheap T-shirts. Yes, Americans save hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars per year because of globalization and the open trading system. And that's all great. But the fact is that there are much more important aspects of trade in how they spur in how trade spurs innovation and competition and general economic dynamism, how trade helps with the global economy, global stability and kind of geopolitical stability, how trade helps the global poor. There are all these benefits out there that go beyond a cheap T-shirt and that are critically important. And then, you know, finally, there is all sorts of cronyism and corruption that is attached to protectionism. And this goes, again, way back to the 1800s and the time of Smoot Hawley and so forth. It's that, you know, some of the earliest forms of political corruption in the United States are related to protectionist tariff policies.
Well,
and so
there,
go ahead.
No,
so as you're saying,
no, this is why history is so important. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, all of those things are critically important. But the fact is that in the trade debate, it is far easier to simply say trade kills jobs than it is to say, no, actually trade leads to better jobs. And we actually have, you know, this great, important comparative advantage and competitive and, you know, all that. I mean, give me a break. Right. And so, and in fact, I created a T-shirt to joke about this whole thing. Right. And that is that, you know, the protectionist side has a three-word message. The free trade side has this, you know, very long and boring, you know,
right,
spiel that by the time you're done, the audience has gone to sleep.
Yeah. So let's talk about where we're at right now. And in terms of the tariffs that are going to hit by the end of the year, I see one estimate, 46 of 50 Apple products will face tariffs by the end of the year. The National Farmers Union, interestingly enough, last Friday hammered Trump on the escalating trade war, saying he was making things worse. This was, of course, the day that everything escalated. They issued a statement saying, it's no surprise that China is slapping even more tariffs on American products. Every time Trump escalates his trade war, China calls his bluff. And why would we expect any differently this time around. And it's no surprise the farmers are again the target. Now, of course, leaving aside politically whether or not farmers are going to stick with him and what is the breaking point, I guess I want to just, you know, go to this question. Donald Trump does not understand the fundamental point that a tariff is an import tax on American consumers. He fundamentally doesn't understand. But explain this to me, Scott. How can Donald Trump not understand who pays tariffs? Who pays these taxes?
Well, you know, I don't know, quite frankly. You know, the fact is that from a pure legal perspective, so leaving aside the economics, but from a pure legal perspective, the person writing the check to the U.S. Customs Department is a U.S. importer almost all of the time. There are a few exceptions, but the vast majority of the folks writing these tariff checks are going to be U.S.-based importers, companies, customs brokers, and the rest. Now, so from a purely kind of practical nuts and bolts area, you have American entities paying the tariffs. But the fact is that when you get into the economics tend to show that the vast majority of what we call the tariff incidence, but really just means the cost, falls on the consuming country of a tariff and the eventually consumers. Now, the Trump administration was kind of sneaky about it at first, and their first rounds of tariffs were, for the most part, on industrial inputs. Now, what that means is that you and I, everyday consumers, might not actually end up seeing the impact of the tariffs because, look, it could get washed out. You'd have corporations in the supply chain in the United States eating the cost of the tariff, but they're consumers too, right? And maybe they won't pass on the tariff. Maybe they'll just eat it. But the problem, of course, is that somebody is paying, and we're actually seeing in the data these days a pretty significant slowdown in U.S. manufacturing. According to one survey that was out earlier this week, the U.S. manufacturing sector just dipped into recession, a slight contraction.
Okay, Scott, this is the part where my head starts to hurt, because the entire rationale behind this trade policy is to revive U.S. manufacturing. And before this trade war began, there was a resurgence in American manufacturing.
Why?
I mean, if for example, like the steel industry, why is the steel industry not prospering given the fact that the president has slapped all of these steel tariffs?
Well, there's two big, I'll get to steel second, but fundamentally, the bigger issue is that there's a fundamental misunderstanding in the administration about the nature of American manufacturing these days. The fact is that over the last 30 plus years, American manufacturers have adapted in a global marketplace and global supply chains have developed. And basically, a global supply chain means that you have American companies that are importing industrial inputs and exporting finished goods or industrial inputs all over the world. And that these products are, these inputs, these components are all getting shipped to different places. They're getting assembled often in China. And getting sent on. And so if you impose tariffs on upstream inputs that American manufacturers need to produce stuff, of course, you're going to be hurting their bottom line. So kind of from a broad perspective, there are major problems with imposing tariffs in an era of global supply chains. You not only hurt your importing side, you end up hurting your exporting side. And that's before you even get into the retaliation. So, of course, the tariffs breed retaliation. The EU has retaliated. India has retaliated. Of course, China has retaliated. All of that can also hit American manufacturers. It's not just hitting farmers. It is hitting them, but not just farmers. But so that's kind of the broad issue. But on the steel side, it's also, you know, this just classic supply and demand problem. So steel prices spiked. And that caused a severe contraction in demand, right? When price goes up, demand goes down. The trade war also further hurt the global economy, which caused commodity prices to collapse. So, and you have a lot of steel producers in the United States that actually import raw steel, steel slab, what we call semi-finished steel. So put this all together and you actually have the U.S. steel industry suffering right now because demand collapsed, global demand hurt a lot of it. And then you have a lot of these steel companies that need imported steel. And so there are a few producers in the United States that are still doing well. These are kind of some of the more advanced mini mill styles. But U.S. Steel, on the other hand, which, you know, the president has championed in various tweets and speeches, is actually laying off workers in the Midwest right now.
And of course, this was completely unpredictable, right? No one could have possibly seen that this sort of thing would happen.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, sarcasm duly noted. The fact is that this is almost textbook economics in terms of what has happened in the trade war. There are tons of papers on this, and they all show this is basically what's going to happen.
Wait. I mean, sorry. Here's the flaw in your entire argument, right?
Yeah.
Because you're talking about textbooks and you're talking about papers,
as
if Donald Trump reads either one of them. Now, on your Twitter page, you have a picture right at the top. You go to Scott Lincecum's, Twitter profile. And this is the answer to everything. This is it. This is the complete global explanation. So you're talking about what textbooks say about economics and tariffs, what all the economic papers say, and yet at the top of your Twitter page, you have a picture of what the president of the United States is watching and who he is listening to, and it is a picture of Lou Dobbs talking to Diamond and Silk. I effing kid you not. Rhino resistance on tariffs. Lou Dobbs is talking with Diamond and Silk. And I'm sorry that people may think I'm being snarky here, but you wonder how does the President of the United States not understand how this works, what the consequences will be, who pays tariffs, what the nature of a trade deficit is? It's because he thinks that Lou Dobbs is somehow an oracle, and Lou Dobbs talks about tariffs with Diamond and Silk. We are so effed, Scott.
Well, you know, look, you would hope that the president has better economic advisors, and that he would listen to them. It appears that he's not listening to the ones that actually know what they're talking about. And look, you know. And I should back off and say one thing that the hard thing about all of this is that while the economics are predictable, the geopolitics aren't. And so look, what is going to happen in the eventual, you know, US-China deal is difficult, really impossible to predict because you're really dealing with, the president has his own political, motivations. The Chinese have their own economic and political motivations. So you really, it's hard to say what's going to happen.
But
it's easy to say what the economics are. And the fact that these guys don't seem to grasp that is really, it's becoming a rather big problem. You know, last year when the trade war started, we were talking about a really tiny fraction of total trade in just steel and aluminum tariffs, a few billion dollars in Chinese goods. But things have escalated rather substantially. And you know, now we're talking about real money. And particularly if the latest round of tariffs go through in December, you know, you're talking about all Chinese imports, essentially, you know, 98-something%. And of course, Chinese retaliation in the same. And that has really substantial ramifications, not just for the U.S. and the Chinese economies, but for all the economies that are caught up in this, whether it's Korea and Japan or Vietnam or Europe or wherever. And it's very hard for investors to figure out what the heck is going to happen next. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen business investment in the United States collapse over the last quarter is that, you know, at some point, if you're looking to spend a few billion dollars on a new manufacturing plant or whatever, And all this craziness is going on, man, you're just gonna hold back and wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, uncertainty is itself a major factor,
right.
And of course, I remember when Republicans and conservatives criticized the Obama administration for injecting
right.
so much uncertainty into the marketplace. Well, speaking of the marketplace and speaking of free enterprise, our episode today is brought to you by Plexaderm and ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, you know that, but there's one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates, and that place is ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. ZipRecruiter sends your job to more than 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. Did I say it's for free? ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. B-U-L-W-A-R-K. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery. Just gone in minutes. It's called Plexaderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexaderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexaderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexaderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexaderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit tryplexaderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's tryplexaderm.com. All right, we are back with Scott Linsacombe, who is one of the lonely voices trying to explain why trade wars are not easy to win. So one other thing that the president does not seem to understand, and I'm really hoping that you can explain this to us in plain English. He doesn't seem to understand what the trade deficit means. And he keeps talking about how the Chinese are stealing $500 billion from
yeah.
us and that this somehow is a terrible thing. And economists
right.
continually try to point out, no, it's not what you think it is, but
right.
none of it penetrates.
No, the most frustrating thing is actually the president's focus on the bilateral trade deficit. So this is the basic, you know, what we send to a single country and what they send back to us, and just in goods, right? And, you know, economists will tend to disagree on the significance of overall trade balances. Mm-hmm. You know, if the United States runs a persistent national trade deficit over a certain number of years, you know, maybe some economists can think that might be a problem. A lot of others don't, but there's at least a debate. However, there's no debate on the meaninglessness of a bilateral trade balance, particularly only looking at goods. And yet the president obsesses over these, you know, and it's not just China. It's Canada and Mexico and Japan and the EU and the rest. And, you know, you talk to any economist and, you know, they're going to be all bald from pulling all their hair out. Because the fact is that a bilateral trade balance really tells you nothing about the trading relationship, because it is simply a routine mathematical calculation. You know, our exports to a country, their exports to us, but it tells you nothing about, for example, the amount of value add in those exports. That gets kind of complicated. But, you know, the basic idea is that an iPhone might be assembled in China, but it actually has parts from all over the world, including the United States. And so just because it comes into the United States as saying $200 from China, it actually, that tells you nothing about how much actual manufacturing activity is embedded in that $200. Same thing goes for the United States and the rest. So that's a big problem. But the other big problem is that, you know, there are more than two countries in the world. So you can have a very, you could have a country with an overall trade surplus that might have a bilateral trade balance for one country. But then that tells you nothing about kind of the macroeconomic trading relationship. And then finally, of course, this idea that these dollars going to China represent the theft, American wealth being drained. Well, that's
right.
Ridiculous, because that is stuff that we are buying voluntarily. You know, when I buy a flat screen TV that's made in China, I'm getting something for the dollars that I am.
I personally have a really large trade deficit with Apple, right?
Correct.
Because I'm using a MacBook Air, I'm using an iPhone, so they have been stealing money from me. I've been losing money, right? But wait, no, I have the computer, I have the cell phone. It is an exchange of money for goods, and he only looks at one part of that formula.
Right, and then it gets to kind of, you know, it's a the embedded fallacy in there, and that's something we trade nerds try to explain, is that trade does not occur between countries. It occurs between individuals. And because of that, the $500 billion trade deficit is not us trading. It's not America trading with China. It's Americans trading with Chinese. And that's a huge distinction, because like you just said, it really reflects individual consumption patterns. Now, those can be affected by really broad macroeconomic trends and the rest. But at the end of the day, I voluntarily choose to purchase something with my money. And that thing might be made in China or might be made abroad, whatever. And the fact is that I am doing, no one's holding a gun to my head doing that. At the same time, no one, you know, the Chinese aren't launching iPhones at us. You know, there aren't missiles dropping HDTVs over our house. Although, let's face it, that'd be kind of awesome.
Not yet.
And so there is this ridiculous, really, when you think about it, idea of when you hear about dumping, a country is dumping. No, that's literally, it's a voluntary economic transaction. I am deciding, I'm clicking a button on Amazon, I am purchasing that thing voluntarily. And so all of that individual economic behavior, all of that voluntariness, it disappears. And especially, and it's not just Trump, you know, I will say this is not a Trump-centric phenomenon. It is a politician phenomenon. Politicians, when they talk about trade, you would think that, again, that these evil countries are just launching, dumping products. They pull a dump truck up to the, you know, Mexico pulls a dump truck up to the border and just dumps a bunch of, you know, washing machines in Texas. And we poor consumers are forced, you know, to purchase these things. So that of course, is just ridiculous.
Well,
and if think about it in that way, it all gets kind of lost when you talk about us and them and the rest.
But there are such things as, there is such a thing as unfair trade, right? I mean, China is does not have completely clean hands here. So there are people who make the case. China has been a bad actor for some time, and, you know, including in the area of intellectual property. And at some point, there needed to be a reckoning. And Trump's argument is, okay, they have not been held accountable for this conduct for a very long time, and this is occurring on my watch. He didn't say that. He said, I am the chosen one. But his point is, I think, that, look, there are a lot of people who have been building up, like I mentioned before, this metal workers group. I mean, they were going, you know, one after another, the way China was stealing the mold, was stealing the jobs, was doing this, was doing that. So what should our response be to the Chinese that don't play by the same set of rules as we play by?
Yeah, and so this is, you know, a classic case of identifying a problem and then picking the absolutely wrong solution, and that being kind of the tariffs and the trade war. The fact is that you will find general agreement among trade experts that various Chinese trade and economic practices are problematic and require some sort of response. The most obvious one is the actual theft of intellectual property, you know, state-sponsored hacking, that kind of thing. And those things do, I think there's agreement, require a response. But then the question really is, what should the response be? And that, I think, is where everything has gone off the rails. The fact is that there are plenty of alternatives, and proven alternatives, I should add, to just simply starting trade wars and taxing our own consumers and manufacturers. And you start with the TPP being the kind of glaring one, right? So here the Obama administration, and I should add the Bush administration before the Obama administration. You know, people don't kind of remember this, but the Bush administration in their late days actually started what became the TPP. And again, the whole idea behind the TPP was to create an Asia-Pacific alternative to China, and to establish new rules related to things like state-owned enterprises and subsidies and all these things that China is allegedly doing that are problematic, but to create new rules and more importantly, in my opinion, to give all of these countries, Japan, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the rest, an alternative market and an alternative source of supply, and to really embed kind of the United States in these economies and kind of create this kind of alternative supply chain. So, we, of course, abandoned that and now are scrambling to get a tiny bit of, you know, new market access for farmers in Japan.
Did Donald Trump understand what the implications were of dumping that? It seemed in some of his comments that he fundamentally misunderstood the relationship of that deal to China and the advantage that it would give to China of scrapping that deal, because your point is that this has been a huge boon to China. That if you're concerned about reining in China, then canceling that deal was one of the worst moves you could have made.
Yeah, well, to answer your question, no, I think this was a political move. The president called it the worst deal ever, and somebody handed him a piece of paper on his first day, and they shipped off the withdrawal letter. I don't think they really thought about the implications with respect to China. And, you know, the most glaring example is Vietnam, right? You know, here the president is encouraging manufacturers to move their supply chains to Vietnam. He's cheering this, get them out of China, move to Vietnam. But at the same time, we maintain tariffs on stuff from Vietnam that would have been eliminated through TPP. So we could have actually encouraged greater financial and trade ties with Vietnam through TPP. And instead, we're treating them like every other country, you know, with just the barreled basic market access. So that's pretty pretty silly.
Yeah.
TPP... So kind of getting back to what you can do about China. So TPP is one big area. I think another big area, and this is something that to the administration's credit, they've done a little bit, is targeted sanctions against individuals and entities that are found to have actually engaged in this kind of state-sponsored hacking and the rest. I mean, the Obama administration did some of this too. But look, we have sanctions that can be quite powerful when targeting specific companies and actors. Certainly should do that. And doing that, again, does not impose taxes on American consumers and manufacturers. It's some kind of a scalpel approach to sanctions. So third point is the World Trade Organization. And believe it or not, contrary to what the president thinks, the United States is undefeated in disputes against China at the WTO. Also little known is that the Chinese actually tend to comply, not perfectly. Nobody is perfect, not the United States. Nobody is perfect at the WTO when it comes to compliance. But the Chinese tend to comply with adverse WTO decisions. In fact, my colleagues at Cato put together a paper and looked at the 20 or so cases that China has lost at the WTO and found them complying as much or more often than the United States complies. And so here you have this tool of multilateral pressure. And the idea is essentially to get a bunch of like-minded countries together and essentially through a admittedly slow process to push the Chinese to improve things like subsidies and intellectual property, which are covered by WTO rules. And, you know, I've always, and I think that again, there's kind of this nugget of truth in Trump administration criticism about the Obama administration, but I don't think they filed enough disputes. There should have been more cases filed, and they should have teamed up with the Europeans and the Japanese and brought more cases. But instead, what are we doing, right? We're actually blowing up the WTO by blocking appellate body judges. We're actually imposing tariffs on products from Japan and the EU. And we're engaged in a little mini trade war with the Europeans right now. And because of that, you really undermined what I think is the most powerful tool in terms of containing China, and that's at the multilateral level. The Chinese tend to really value their image as being a responsible global stakeholder. They tend to respond more to multilateral pressure, and we've taken that totally off the table, and again, are just basically using tariffs.
So let's switch gears to the impact of the economy of this trade war. And I think the one time I ever talked with Donald Trump was in my old life as a talk show host, and we talked about tariffs and trade wars, and he was basically suggesting at that time it wouldn't be so bad because he would just simply threaten to impose the tariffs and the Chinese would cave in, and therefore he would never have to do it. I thought that was a bad negotiating strategy to basically say you were bluffing, and clearly the Chinese have called his bluff. Well, now we have the impact. So today we get the report: U.S. economy slowed in the spring. Many economists think the slowdown will continue through the second half of the year. Possible headwind for Trump's reelection. Commerce Department says that the GDP advanced at a moderate 2% annual rate in the April to June quarter, down from 3.1% in the first quarter. New estimate lower than the government's initial estimate a month ago of 2.1% annual growth. Kind of an uh-oh moment. But you have Peter Navarro out there saying, and then I have the quote written down here. They were talking about the, you know, among the scary warning signals, the inverted yield curve, that the yield curve is inverted because of very bullish circumstances. So he's out there saying this inverted yield curve, it's not only not a warning sign that things are going bad, it's a sign that things are just going swimmingly.
Yeah, and look, I mean, it's kind of manifestly ridiculous. You know, if you go back, and I think Catherine Rampell of the Washington Post did this, and look at Peter Navarro's own books on various economics, talk about the inverted yield curve as being a clear sign of a pending recession. Now, look, I think that a clear sign of pending recession is far different from being in a recession.
Right.
Right. And it could be months or years before one, and maybe things change. But the idea that this is some symbol of economic awesomeness is you know, pretty crazy. And the fact is that there are obviously a lot more things going on than trade, but and things, whether it's the Fed or global growth and stimulus and whatever. The fact is, though, that trade really sticks out as kind of the big unforced error in all of this, in the sense of, you know, business cycles slow. There are certainly global economic forces out of your control. But if you look at the one thing that, you know, going back 18 months ago, that there was 100% consensus among the folks that know about this stuff as to what should not occur, it's a trade war. And for all the reasons we've discussed. And so, you know, I think that when history is written about this moment, if things do go further south, you know, that's really the one that I think sticks out as, you know, what on earth were they thinking? Because, you know, the Fed, look, there was a lot of debate last year about whether rates were, you know, whether the Fed was too tight or too loose and what the Fed should do next. The Fed also was dealing with this crazy trade environment that was changing every day. So, you know, maybe they got it wrong, but the fact is that there was a lot of reason for getting it wrong if they did. And the same goes for, look, business cycles are inevitable and the rest. But the trade war is that one area where everybody was saying, please don't do this. This is a huge mistake. We know it's going to be a mistake.
Okay.
And yet, you know, here we are.
I almost hesitate to ask you this question because I think you're absolutely right. People are going to go, what were you actually thinking? Why did you think that this would be a great time to bring back Smoot-Hawley? But, you know, once again, there are free traders still left in the Republican Party, in theory, and every once in a while they will pop their heads up. But why has there been so much reluctance on the part of, and it's not uniform, and I am generalizing here, the business community, Republican elected officials, free market advocates, to really push back at this point, not just on the policy, but on the unilateralism of the policy that, I mean, I will tell you that before Trump, I did not imagine that the president of the United States could unilaterally, on his own, without congressional action, impose hundreds of billions of dollars in new taxes. I did not think the system worked that way. And yet there seems to be almost no resistance on the right to these policies that 5 minutes ago were universally opposed.
Yeah. Well, so there's two big problems. The first is that, you know, Congress, through a series of laws over the last about 100 years, has delegated vast swaths of its constitutional authority over tariffs. You know, look, Article 1, Section 8, very, very clear. Congress alone has tariff power. But Congress has delegated that power to the president, going back to the Smoot-Hawley era. Now, why did Congress do that? Well, the presumption, which was a pretty good one until about 3 years ago, was that the president, given his national constituency, would be the most free trade person in the government. And because of that, the president could be more trusted to not engage in protectionism, at least politically motivated protectionism, as opposed to Congress. Because again, going back to the late 19th century and early 20th century, tariff policy was set by Congress, and it was a cronyist debacle. And so the presumption there was pretty sound until Donald Trump came along. So you have this legal system that was totally set up based on an erroneous presumption that Trump is taking advantage of. So that gives you the first problem. The second problem, though, is the lack of political pushback stems from how difficult it is to get a veto-proof majority to change these laws. So you're not simply talking about needing 50 votes in the Senate. You would need veto proof in both the House and the Senate, because of course the president's going to veto that. So that creates a really clear political incentive for Republicans to just keep their heads down. For base political reasons, for very practical reasons, even if they disagree with the policy, the fact is that if you can't get veto proof majorities, what's the point? Right. And so those of us would hope they would stand on principle. You can understand, I think, the politics of it. And I think the only problem would be if things really go south. And the fact is that I think that on China, that you're just not going to see that political coalition emerge. However, if the president, I think the president, if he had gone through with the car tariffs as they were contemplated at one point, I think you would have actually seen veto-proof majorities appear. But it just doesn't seem like with what's going on right now that there's a willingness to do that.
No, there's not. So what would happen if the president, of course, last Friday said that he hereby ordered American companies to begin pulling out of China or looking at pulling out of China. Of course, there was a lot of debate about whether or not the president had that power. The answer, probably not, right? But he has sweeping powers to really squeeze it. So what would happen if the president basically decided with a second term and electoral headwinds? I mean, what's the opposite of headwinds? Tailwinds. Behind him. Basically said, I want all American companies out of China. What would the impact be on world trade and our own economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think you would see markets tank. The fact is that there really just is the Well, first of all, the legal uncertainty, right? So you mentioned that there's a lot of question about what the president can and can't do under the various trade statutes I just mentioned. But the fact is that it would throw so much of the U.S. and world economies into flux that I think you'd see a pretty severe market reaction. But the other question is, what would American companies do? Well, look, you know, I don't think there are a lot of multinational companies that are going to abandon the Chinese market. They're certainly not doing that in the midst of this current trade war. So you'd see a lot of attempts to kind of, bifurcate their business. You'd have a China business and a U.S. business, and an area the twain shall meet, right? And all of that would be immensely costly, just in terms of, not just the mere practical aspect of splitting everything up, but in terms of, the uncertainty surrounding that. And so, the good news here, if there is any good news in all of this, is that the market is sending the president a pretty clear signal, and that appears to be the best guardrails we have, that every time the president gets a little too far out over his skis, the market tanks. And that seems to be the best check right now. Now, that said,
to the extent that he pays attention, to the extent that he actually understands what that signal is.
Yeah, I think he does.
Probably.
The fact is that, there was just a report today that all those bold statements of the G7 over the weekend when he was standing there with Macron talking about how the Chinese called him and how everything's great, apparently aides were admitting behind the scenes that was all made up just to calm markets. So he is clearly aware of how markets are
I'm not sure that that's reassuring that we now know that the president was willing to lie to call markets.
No,
because once the markets figured out that he's simply going to lie.
These are silver linings and dark clouds. But the fact is that the president does seem to understand that this can have a pretty significant market reaction.
But it's not clear that he knows how to respond or what to do. The other scary thing, though, is that he's so branded on hashtag winning that while he may understand that, he does not know how to extricate himself from this. And this is part of the problem, right, of a spiraling, escalating trade war, is that nobody wants to blink first. And obviously the Chinese have a longer time horizon on this, and they see the president sweating, and the president knows he can't look weak going into this. So this is where we're like, screw. This is why playing games of chicken or Russian roulette are usually bad choices, bad life choices.
And as you mentioned, the fact is that it would be great if Congress would step in. The other point I was going to say is I do think that if really we get to something as severe as, ordering all companies out of a country or something, then I think you would see a more concerted effort in Congress to reel in that power, whether it is the tariff power or whether it is changing the national emergency powers. There are bills that are floating around that have already been written. They've already been considered in committee and they're sitting there. If we really did get to kind of a crisis point, I hope you would see congressional action. Gotten there yet.
Well, even as we're speaking, we have a CNN report, Trump defends trade war with China amid GOP fears of economic impact. And then he just tweeted out, I think it was yesterday, he's lashing out at the Federal Reserve. Our Federal Reserve cannot mentally keep up with the competition. Other countries at the G7 in France, all of the other leaders were giddy about how low their interest rate costs have gone. Germany is actually getting paid to borrow money. Zero interest plus, no clue Fed. So, one of the reactions, as opposed to making rational economic choices, will be to simply find another scapegoat, find a someone to blame for it. So we will have to have you back to talk about that. And also, Scott, I'd be interested in having a discussion with you on who's a greater threat to the markets going forward, Donald Trump and his trade policies or Bernie Sanders' plans to totally transform the American economy into his image. But so thank you for all of this time today on the Bulwark Podcast, Scott.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by Plexaderm and ZipRecruiter. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.